It's Thursday, September 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, the United States prepares to lift sanctions against Myanmar as Aung San Suu Kyi visits Washington. Parts of North Korea are devastated by floods.
This is an extremely powerful system. It's covering a very, wide area.
A massive storm takes aim at Taiwan and China. Also ahead, financial markets are again uncertain, and the worst maritime oil disaster personalized. In the movies, that is. It's all on today's International Edition. President Barack Obama has announced that the United States is prepared to lift economic sanctions on Myanmar. That follows talks at the White House with the country's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi.
The United States is now prepared to lift sanctions that we have imposed on Burma for quite some time. It is the right thing to do in order to ensure that the people of Burma see rewards from a new way of doing business and a new government.
After their remarks, a reporter shouted a question at the president about the timeline for lifting U.S. economic sanctions. Mr. Obama replied, soon. VOA White House correspondent Cindy Sain described more of the meeting with International Edition host Sarah Williams.
The president encouraged Americans to travel to Burma, saying it's a beautiful country with wonderful people and a budding tourism industry that would welcome them. So it looks like it's been a most productive meeting here.
But there are also human rights concerns, particularly in regard to minorities in Myanmar. How do those concerns factor in these talks?
Well, they were addressed. The president brought them up, and Aung San Suu Kyi also said that these were concerns in a very poor state where that should not be ignored. And she is vowing to continue to work on that and asking the U.S. and other countries as partners to work with them. So the Congress, of course, will also have a role in this. And Aung San Suu Kyi met with congressional leaders at Vice President Biden's residence.
Suu Kyi, she's not Myanmar's president. She holds titles of state counselor and foreign minister. But this meeting with Mr. Obama seems to reinforce her status as the country's really actual leader.
That's right. She's not president, but it's shown very clearly that she is viewed here, at least, as a civilian leader of the country. And her remarks, she said that she, wants the military to be respected and beloved in her country, but the military should have no place in politics, saying that there's still much to be done in the way of democratic reforms in her country.
This was Aung San Suu Kyi's first visit to the United States as state counselor and foreign minister, a position she assumed after her party's decisive win in last November's elections. The country's militia-era constitution bars her from holding the title of president because her late husband and children are foreign citizens. Aung San Suu Kyi spent more than 20 years under house arrest in the country formerly known as Burma. Her meeting with Obama in the Oval Office is viewed as another clear indication that she is Myanmar's de facto civilian leader. Over the past 20 years, the White House and Congress have maintained a long list of sanctions on Myanmar, including restrictions on jade and gemstones and on businesses linked to the sales of arms and illegal drugs. Mr. Obama eased some of those sanctions in 2013. It's time for us now to check out what's trending online, and we do that with International Edition's G. Abby Lee. She's sitting right here in Studio 22 to discuss the trending topics, hashtags, and much more. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim. The trending hashtags at this hour all have to do with Carla Hayden, who is a new Librarian of Congress. They include hashtag Library of Congress, of course, and hashtag Hayden is LOC. She made history Wednesday as... wait for it. It's a double whammy. The first woman and also the first African-American to head the de facto National Library.
Wow, that's history indeed. Tell us what the White House tweeted.
Sure. It shared a video clip highlighting Hayden's career and captioned it, "Today, Dr. Carla Hayden will be sworn in as hashtag Librarian of Congress. Find out why at POTUS nominated her." Now, to that tweet, some people replied it's overdue, but others argued she will remove some important reference to Christianity and American history from the library.
Interesting. Well, I'm sure we're going to be watching
Indeed.
For that. Is she on Twitter?
She is. She has a brand new account at LIBN, Librarian of Congress. Her first and only one of the two tweets so far reads like this. Hello, Twitter. I am Carla Hayden, the 14th Librarian of Congress. Let's explore at Library Congress together. Nearly 2,000 people liked that tweet within 30 minutes.
Wow, pretty swift move.
Mm-hmm.
Well, speaking of swift, let's turn to tech news. Ride-sharing company Uber has rolled out some self-driving cars in Pittsburgh this week, I understand.
That's right. And like you said, why in Pittsburgh where the terrain is not really great because they're apparently known to be very curvy and rocky?
Yeah, it's not. Well, let's just say it's not flat there.
Okay. So they could have chosen. Why do you think they actually chose to have it there?
Either they're really confident or they didn't know.
Well, actually, I can kind of believe being confident because if you go to the City of Pittsburgh Twitter page, which is at CityPGH, it's a lot. There's a lot of information and also some selfies of, you know, government officials, trying out the new thing. And the self-driving cars are pretty easy to spot because it has a mound of spinning instruments perched on top. And you said there are some other features as well?
Yeah, it looks like a big roof rack full of little lasers, I guess, to help guide the cars around.
That's wonderful. Okay, well, that's all for me today, Jim.
Well, thanks so much for that wrap-up, G, and guiding us through social media trends. And you can follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Our own individual accounts are out there as well, ready for you to follow at VOA Stevenson and at G Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia, India promises $1 billion in aid during Afghan president's visit. India and Afghanistan call for an end to all support of militants. Thailand moves to end military trials of civilians and draws a mixed response. The report says corruption substantially undermined the U.S. mission in Afghanistan. Maldives' first democratic president allies with ex-strongman. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at the VOAnews.com website and through your smartphone if you have the VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. A large-scale recovery effort involving some 200,000 people is now underway in northern North Korea following devastating flooding that began August 30th and has so far known to have killed nearly 140 people and displaced tens of thousands. At least 400 are still missing. Poor infrastructure and deforestation have made the country vulnerable to flooding. Some 140,000 are described as being in urgent need and having lost their homes and belongings, with some 600,000 others affected by a loss of drinking water, ruined crops, and lack of health care. Tens of thousands of homes and other structures like schools were totally or partially destroyed. Chris Staines is the head of the Pyongyang office of the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. He was part of an international relief delegation that visited one of the sites of the flooding last week that borders China, and he described to VOA's Victor Beatty via Skype what he saw.
And on the road, we observed thousands of people working to try and build roads and recover the roads. We also saw damaged crops. We saw damaged bridges. We saw houses that had been destroyed or washed away or partially damaged. Basically, the floodwaters were very fast. They were high. They came and they took everything with them. And the debris and the rubble also caused further losses. So people have lost everything. They've lost their houses. They've lost their clothing. They've lost their kitchen gardens. They've lost their livestock. They've lost their food supplies. The water system in Haryong City has been destroyed, so the 52,000 people who were relying on that for safe water now have to go back to recovering water from streams and from an old hand pump system of tubular wells The water quality is not great at the moment. People need to boil water. There's a shortage of fuel for boiling the water. So the situation is very complex, and that's just within Heryong City.
Chris, what supplies are most needed?
The priorities are in a number of areas. There's in terms of shelter, making sure people have safe shelter. The seasons are starting to change there already. We had one day when it was definitely cooler, and there are signs of autumn on the hillsides all around. So shelter is a premium. Safe drinking water is absolutely necessary. People need to be able to have access to water purification tablets, to fuel, to boil water. They need food. They need good health services, or at least access to some health services. The risk of communicable diseases like diarrhea, the risk of acute respiratory infections and pneumonia, all of those things are increasing as time goes by.
What caused the flooding?
It was a combination. It was one of those nasty situations where a couple of things come together. So it was definitely the tail end of Typhoon Lion Rock, together with a low depression which was stopped over the Tumen River area in both parts of China and parts of North of DPRK that are bordered or bounded by the Tumen River. I understand that there was a flood or tidal surge associated with the Lion Rock, which meant that up to a metre of water at the rivers where they empty into the Sea of Japan had actually, if you like, caused a block, which then prevented the floodwaters from exiting into the sea, which meant that they had to flow over the banks and increase the impact and the damage.
Chris Dane said the Red Cross is seeking donations to help the victims of the flooding. A massive and intense storm called Meranti brushed across southern Taiwan on Wednesday, and it's described as on par with Super Typhoon Haiyan that devastated the Philippines back in 2013 that killed more than 6,000 people. Meteorologist Steve Travis of AccuWeather at State College, Pennsylvania, says Meranti is considered the strongest storm anywhere in the world so far this year.
At the current time, it has sustained winds near 290 kilometers per hour. That's, you know, puts it in the classification of a super typhoon, which at its current status is as strong as a Category 5 hurricane would be. So, you know, this is an extremely powerful system. It's covering a very wide area. The outer rain bands from the system are already reaching into southeast China and, you know, much of northern Taiwan as well. It's a very broad system. It's going to bring very strong winds, winds of over probably 200 kilometers per hour and very heavy rainfall as well. The rain is going to be a really, bad factor from the system. We could see rainfall exceeding around 250 millimeters of rain. Some places could pick up as much as 500 millimeters of rain, and with rain that's, this heavy, that's going to lead to, very widespread flooding from the storm. It just became very strong very quickly, and that was due to the very warm waters that are over the western Pacific right now, and it was in an almost ideal situation for this storm to strengthen. Very low winds surrounding the storm, which really helped it to intensify, and then those very warm ocean waters as well. And, from this point on, it's really just going to slowly weaken as it gets towards southeastern China, but it's going to remain a very strong system.
And right behind that is yet another storm expected to miss Taiwan, move to the east of China, but dump a lot of rain on Japan. Financial market volatility is beginning to push markets up and down. The U.S. Treasury yield curve hit its steepest in more than 2 months on Wednesday, and world stock markets edged lower as investors fretted about the future of U.S. interest rate hikes. A jump in Apple shares briefly touched a 2016 high, though, and that limited some slight losses on the S&P 500 index. To fill us in on all of this and also a big bank is VOA financial correspondent Jill Malandrino from New York.
It's been interesting because since the Brexit vote, we've had nearly 45 days of range-bound trade. That all changed last Friday on concerns of an interest rate hike, potentially at the September 21st meeting or at some point in 2016. We have two more meetings in November and December. I don't think it's necessarily the fact that we're going to get 25 basis point rise. That's really just a kick in the bucket, if you will. And essentially, it's just the way that the Fed and other central bankers have orchestrated the market, where we're starting to see asset bubbles created is really what the concern is. So it's not the act of the interest rate hike itself, but I think it's more of the concern of asset bubbles being inflated. So I think we're going to continue to see some of this volatility, at least through the September 21st meeting, whether we get the vote then or whether we get some more clarity into the timing of the interest rate hike. But I think that's really what the market's going to be focused on, because in absence of that, there is no more economic data that will move the needle this week. And until earnings kicks in on October 10th, I believe the second week in October, there really isn't much out there. It's what we call an earnings vacuum or news vacuum. It's really just macro that we're focusing on right now. The Fed, however, is in its quiet period, so I don't expect to hear anything, whether dovish or hawkish, coming out of the members themselves.
Whenever there is a talk about interest rate hikes, the financial sector always is something that we watch. Banks tend to react to a rate hike favorably. However, one bank in particular, Wells Fargo, is having a bit of a rough patch at the moment.
Yeah, Wells Fargo has been interesting to watch. It was announced that nearly over 5,000 employees were fired because they were creating fake accounts to meet sales goals. Now, when I started on Wall Street a million years ago, my first position was in a bank working on what they called the platform, which is where the sales reps, not the tellers, but the other sales reps in the banks, have very specific goals to make. And back then, it wasn't quite as aggressive as it is now. So I think that has to say a lot about the culture and the reputation of the bank. The losses for Wells Fargo were pretty extensive on Tuesday. It's kind of tough to tell if that wasn't just a measure of the market overall being under pressure, but there are bigger questions about how the potential impact on its business will be. It was up fractionally today as the market was relatively quiet. We've sold off in the back half of the day. But CEO John Stumpf, he said in a statement that we want to make certain our customers have full confidence that our retail bankers are always focused on the best interests of customers. Now, restoring that confidence will be a tall order, and how badly it's been shaken up is the obvious question. Another question lingering about this is whether Stumpf still has Warren Buffett's full confidence. Now, Warren Buffett's the legendary investor whose Berkshire Hathaway owns 10% of Wells Fargo, and they actually applied with regulators to acquire additional shares earlier in the summer. So there's some pretty big questions outside of interest rate hikes that Wells Fargo is going to have to work through.
We own 100% of your great insight every time you're with us. Joe Malandrino, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. A new movie takes a more personal look at the worst marine oil spill in history on board a drilling platform in the Gulf of Mexico. As International Edition's David Byrd tells us, Deepwater Horizon looks at the lives of some of the people killed in the initial explosion, as well as the aftermath of the disaster.
In April of 2010, an explosion and fire crippled the oil drilling platform the Deepwater Horizon in the Gulf of Mexico. Cement, meant to contain the natural gas in the well, failed, and the gas shot up the drilling tube and ignited. 11 workers were killed and 17 others injured in the explosion. The rig, which was leased by British Petroleum and operated by Transocean, sank. Then a device called a blowout preventer, which is intended to stop oil from leaking out of the well 1,500-plus meters below, failed. Millions of barrels of oil leaked into the Gulf over the next few weeks. In the film Deepwater Horizon, Mark Wahlberg plays oil rig worker Mike Williams. At the film's premiere at the Toronto Film Festival, Wahlberg said that rebuilding the disaster site in Louisiana during hurricane season was challenging, but worth the effort for the integrity of the film.
But, you know, it's the kind of movie like Lone Survivor where it's not about your own individual experience and you suck it up because, you know, we're paying tribute to the 11 people that lost their lives and all the men and women who were able to survive the Deepwater tragedy. So, you know, when you are aware of those things, it makes it a lot easier.
Actress Kate Hudson plays Mike Williams' wife, Felicia. She says there was added pressure knowing that the real families of the real victims would see the movie.
And so there's this little extra importance that's put on making sure that you get it right. And so I think that was one. And also, I just, it's nice to be a part of a film that kind of switches it. You know, you got this, obviously, enormous environmental disaster, but at the same time, you know, we kind of lost sight of the fact that 11 lives were lost, and it's nice to sort of pay homage to them and their families.
Veteran actor Kurt Russell plays Deepwater manager Jimmy Harrell. Russell says he hadn't known about the number of people killed on the rig until he read the script.
But I had no idea. I had no idea 11 people had died. I didn't see anything on that. I didn't see anything on the oil rig burning. Explosions that you could see from space. I didn't know that there were acts of miraculous heroism that occurred to help people stay alive. I thought, yeah, where's that? That story is not as important as the ecological potential disaster.
Director Peter Berg credits his Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist uncle for his passion for depicting real stories. He also directed and produced Wahlberg's 2013 reality-based Lone Survivor.
I've always been a believer that if you can find a real great story and you can get access to those the people who are part of it and the culture that they represent, that to me is where the inspiration comes, and that's where the gold is for me.
Deepwater Horizon also stars Oscar nominee John Malkovich, Maze Runner star Dylan O'Brien, and Jane the Virgin star Gina Rodriguez. The film is rated PG-13 for language and intense disaster sequences. Deepwater Horizon opens in U.S. theaters September 30th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition. For director Tracy Carter and engineer Carl Starling, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
18 months ago, a conflict between Yemen's elected Sunni government and the Houthi opposition, allied with elements loyal to the country's former president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, escalated into a civil war. Subsequently, at the request of the elected Yemeni government, a coalition led by Saudi Arabia launched military airstrikes against the Houthi rebels. And, as is usual in armed conflict, it is the civilian population that suffers the most. Since the conflict broke out in March of last year, some 6,500 people have been killed, about half of them civilians. At the same time, more than 3.1 million Yemenis have been displaced, and more than 80% of the country, or 21 million people, are in need of humanitarian assistance. The numbers don't begin to capture the true depth of the tragedy, but they are nevertheless staggering, said Secretary of State John Kerry at a recent press conference. Food shortages have driven prices up 60% since last March, and they have brought the country to the brink of famine. The Yemeni people need help, and they need it now. But unfortunately, donations are slow in coming, said Secretary of State Kerry. To date, the international response to this crisis has fallen short of filling the gap between the supplies that are available and those that are required. To help fill that gap, the United States, already the largest donor of aid to Yemen, will contribute another $189 million in urgently needed humanitarian assistance. The new funding will go toward additional food and nutritional assistance, emergency health care, hygiene kits, and psychosocial support. It will also help improve access to drinking water and sanitation. Some of the money will also go toward providing food and shelter for Yemeni refugees in the Horn of Africa. We strongly urge other countries in and outside the region to expand their contributions as well, said Secretary of State Kerry. Every party has an obligation to allow the unfettered flow of humanitarian assistance to Yemenis in all parts of the country. That is necessary to save lives, and it is also mandated under international law. And it is the right thing to do.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.